You're listening to the Bearded Theologians podcast, hosted by Zach Bechtold and Matt Franks. If you'd like to learn more about the Bearded Theologians, you can go online at beardedtheologians.com, where we have past podcasts, blogs, and a couple of items for sale. So check us out, beardedtheologians.com. Thank you for listening and enjoy this week's show.
You're listening to the Bearded Theologians podcast, hosted by Matt Franks
and Zach Bechtold. And we have a very special guest with us, friend of the podcast, Dr. Andrew Root with us, who is the Kerry Olson Balson Professor of Youth and Family Ministry at Luther Seminary. We've had Andrew on before, and Andrew, we're so glad to have you back with us.
It's great to be back.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, will you remind our listeners kind of, you know, who you are, where you're from, what you do?
Well, I would be shocked that they don't remember. I mean, I would think everyone would have this all memorized by now. But no, yeah. So I live in St. Paul, right on the border of St. Paul and Minneapolis. But it's very important for people from St. Paul to let you know we're from St. Paul and not from Minneapolis, because, you know, those Minneapolis people are snooty. So we're the salt of the earth people here in the Twin Cities. I'm sitting in my office, and it's incredibly humid here in the Twin Cities today. But I teach at Luther Seminary, like you said. This is my 18th year, which feels kind of crazy. But I've been here for a while, and write some books and talk about some ideas that are people in ministry are wrestling with. And I don't know. Is that a good enough update? Or
That's great.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
No, that's awesome. Thank you. It's always weird when we're like, hey, talk about yourself. And you're like, oh, okay.
Yeah. Like how to frame that. Does it go into like psychoanalysis or something?
Right.
You know, like, tell us about the relationship you have with your dad.
That's right. We could do a psych eval on you. It wouldn't be worth anything, but we could do it. Well, cool, man. You have a new book coming out, it's already out. I don't remember. I apologize for my dates. But When the Church Stops Working, tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, it is out, but you know, who knows when people are listening to this. So, you know, if you're listening backward in the space-time continuum, maybe it will be coming out. But I think you can get it most at most Amazons. You can find it. But it's got a very clickbait title, When the Church Stops Working. And it is definitely a book that's wrestling with larger kind of ecclesiological kind of realities and thinking about the church in our time. But ultimately it's a synthesis of kind of this 6-volume Ministry in the Secular Age series that I've been doing, which I think I talked on this podcast with some of you about one of the volumes of that book. So this is really written. Those books are hard. Like I, you know, it's probably a little bit of my lack of skill as a writer is probably part of the reason they're hard. And my obsession with footnotes is probably another reason they're hard. But they are really books written for kind of the seminary, the pastor who has some kind of seminary education, I think. But I would get so many calls from folks that would say, I would, you know, this is really helpful for me, but I'd like to talk to my session or my church council or my leadership team about this, but they're just not going to wade through a bunch of, you know, footnotes on Charles Taylor or something. So, you know, how do I talk to them about this? So this book is really born out of that. It's a book written for kind of lay folks and really for people in pastoral ministry to lead folks in their church into a kind of conversation about some of these larger themes. And so that's the idea behind it. And so it's co-written with my friend Blair Bertrand, who's a Canadian guy, which I don't know why I always reference that he's from Canada. I'm kind of apologizing for it, I guess, which is just to throw shade on my Canadian friends, but friend of mine. And he's just had a lot of skill in both kind of understanding the larger argument I was going after and working with boards and sessions and councils and things like that.
Nice. That's a solid Canadian move, just to go ahead and apologize for your friend.
You have to.
I
should have said sorry. I should have said it's co-written. Sorry about that. By a Canadian. Really sorry about that.
That's awesome. You know, Matt and I talk a lot about, you know, just running off the title, When the Church Stops Working, right? We talk a lot about that idea here on the podcast. And what do we do when things just aren't? especially post-COVID, right? COVID really, I truly don't think COVID made things stop working in the church. I think it just highlighted it, the realities in which we were facing, right? And so we talk a lot about that concept of what do we do now? What's next? How do we not fix it, but how do we move forward? And so having resources that lean into that's huge.
Yeah, and in this odd kind of way, and maybe this is kind of a post-COVID thing as well, is the title kind of has a dual meaning here, because we definitely do believe that there's this, that we're in this moment where it feels like the kind of structures and visions we've had for church life, especially within Protestantism, if we just stick there, and maybe we should just stick with American Protestantism or Protestantism in the West, but that it isn't really kind of working or not like it did before. But there's also this sense that we really feel is the big trap, is that when it feels like it isn't working, one of the things we've often been told our whole lives, particularly if we're kind of middle class people, is that then you should work harder. You know, you should double down and work harder and do more. And, you know, just if it's going down, you should go down fighting. And so we actually think part of the problem is that the church is working too hard. Like there's a sense where the church needs to stop working. And I don't think we mean that as kind of a sense of efficacy, but we mean that in a sense of trying to dig ourselves out of a hole, that the more we try to dig ourselves out of the hole, the deeper I think we make it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think that that's a good point to make, is that I think sometimes, and I know Zach and I probably encounter this on a semi-daily basis, that people want to do more, but it may not necessarily be the more that is needed. And that challenge of like, well, we got to save the church and we need more of young people. We need more, whatever. I think you're right. You nailed on the head, is that that's not what we need. I think slowly, I've found myself doing that, especially even since COVID, coming out of it, slowing down and evaluating what's necessary. What do we need? What would make us a healthy space? I think that that's just a great thing to reflect on, is are we doing too much?
Yeah. Yeah. And it is odd because, you know, like I said, the book is directed towards kind of lay leaders. And I think one of the beautiful things about lay leaders is that they're kind of ready to put their money where their mouth is, I guess. Maybe that's not the best expression here. Maybe in a real way, they're putting their money where their mouth is by, you know, funding certain things and things like that. But they are giving a lot of time. And usually, however, when you talk to those folks, and I, you know, this isn't to disparage them in any way, I think that they're the saints of our churches, but they do have this sense that they pick up from somewhere, like the church is dying, that it is going down, and I need to try to save it. I am here to try to turn things around. And that just has also just a peculiarity to it, a certain kind of theological peculiarity to it, to imagine that the church as the very body of Jesus Christ is somehow in utter danger. And that doesn't mean we're not in difficult times, and institutionally we're not in difficult times, but there can become this almost over-functioning that we have, that we feel like, okay, you know, all the type A people in our church, so we're going to do it. We're going to do more. And, you know, we're going to get ourselves out of this hole, or we're going to give more money and then hire more staff. And then, you know, it does sometimes feel like the kind of last spasm of hyperactivity in the midst of the death curl coming. And again, you know, that even sounds too dramatic, because I don't believe theologically we can say that the church is on its way towards non-existence. I mean, sometimes I hear people are like, if we don't get our crap together here, there's going to be no church. And that just feels like an utter theological mistake. It doesn't mean that our denominations will exist as they have, or, you know, certain structures we love and, you know, my gosh, seminaries that have blessed me so much are going to all stay open. Like, there could be radical changes, but there also can be a deep breath that the church, that there's a dynamic that the church does kind of point eschatologically, and that the church is as long as we're in the time before the fulfillment of the kingdom, the church will continue to move. Mm-hmm. And so it doesn't need to be saved. It's the ark saves us. And we need to remember that, I think.
You know, we've talked a lot about that in our Methodist circles here in the last few years, with what we're going through on the denominational level with schisms and splits and here and there. And what's really, I mean, we're resurrection people, right? We believe in resurrection. We believe in birth after death. And why is this any different? Why, you know, that's really helped me in the last few years looking at the church and not sink, have that sinking feeling and get stuck in that, oh God, we're just going to die. And yeah, so what if we're different? So what if this part of who we are just sits in history and we move forward into something new and beautiful that we didn't know was there? There's something freeing about that, especially in the light of if we just do more to go back to the way it was 50 years ago. Well, maybe what? Why? Why do we want to go back there instead of embracing what's before us? I mean, we all know the world is completely different now than it was 50 years ago, 25, 10, 2. We live in a different world, so we're not going back. How do we embrace and move forward? And I love this idea of, well, less is maybe more, right? How do we take a step back and go, okay, here's what is life-giving. Here's what is meaningful and sacred to folks. How do we move forward with that? That's a huge conversation.
It is. And you know, and I do think, like, I don't want, you know, people to listen to this or to read the book and be like, oh, well, that is a certain kind of denialistic, you know, pietism to be like, who cares? You know, I mean, it'd be a little bit like watching your house burn down and being like, what are houses? And, you know, and I have insurance and, you know, who cares? You know, that we are in the midst of a crisis. There's just no doubt about that. But I do, you know, and I guess this is where it links up with the larger kind of series of the more kind of academic-y books that I've been doing, is that I really do think across American Protestantism, we've got the crisis wrong. It's not wrong that we feel like we're at a point of crisis. That's absolutely true. But I do think we have the crisis wrong. And the crisis that we usually kind of, that for lack of a better term, has kind of colonized our imagination is the crisis of the decline. You know, like you were all just mentioning, you know, like fewer young people, fewer relevance for our denomination, you know, fewer members, fewer people giving. That seems to always be the crisis. And too often that's like why people join leadership and lay leadership in the church. Like I'm going to help upend this crisis. And I do think there is a crisis, and to be a Protestant, you kind of have to have a crisis at the center. I just think that's, you know, just part of the Protestant imaginary. But I think the crisis we face is, you know, again, it's more of the crisis of how do we help people respond to, well, first hear and then respond to the living God who calls them into life. Who's ministering in the world. Like, that's the real crisis. The real crisis is how do we encounter a living, speaking God who's moving in history again? And I think too often, you know, what keeps pastors and bishops and others up late at night is like one roof leak and we're done. Or if we can't get ourselves up to 15, 20% increase in whatever metric you want, then what future do we have? Instead of maybe losing some sleep, which maybe we all should lose some sleep some nights, but what's keeping us awake is like, how do I help these people imagine and then respond to the very actuality of a God who moves in their lives, who is speaking to them? And that will take a very different form of action. You know, to respond to that crisis will not be the kind of action of we got to do more with less. We got to innovate. We got to go. We got to find some inner genius within us and we got to do this. You know, we got to risk. We got to do this. We got to do that. It will, I think, have more of a disposition of learning how to wait and how to wait on God and become more attentive to the stories around us and become more aware of the relationships. And it will take a kind of sense of waiting for God.
Yeah, you definitely highlight that in the book. One of the things that one of the spots that I definitely highlighted and marked was the idea of tension. And you had talked about no tension equals no community. And like, that's something I have encountered in a lot of places where people like, well, you know, we don't want to be, you know, we don't want to be held in tension because, you know, that's it's that false dichotomy that we can't disagree, but we, you know, we're going to be together in worship. That like that can't exist. We all have to be of one mind. And I know, like for me, like when I started coming to church, the thing that drew me in was that I didn't have to be of one mind. That I was allowed to ask my questions, to be in a space to where as a new believer, I could ask things like, why do you do this? Like, you're eating the body and drinking the blood of Christ. Like, how barbaric is that? Like, but being able to have that space to ask that question and to while having that tension, but being able to be in community together, because we recognize that tension, you know, and just say, oh, that's, you know, that's Tom. He's just, that's who he is. But yet we sit together and worship every Sunday because we love each other. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about that idea of tension and why it's healthy tension in the church is a good thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's really a point that comes from Bonhoeffer, which, you know, I think at the end of the day, everything I do is just a kind of rip off or spin off from Bonhoeffer's from Dietrich Bonhoeffer's work. But in Life Together, I mean, this is one of the pieces people often miss about that book, is, you know, that book is everyone's favorite. You know, you talk to people like, oh, I love Bonhoeffer. I loved Life Together. We read it in college. It changed my life. And then, you know, you realize that people didn't really read it, because there's some pretty radical things in it. And one of them is where he really talks about the difference between the idea of the church and the actuality of the church. And that there are a lot of people, and there are a lot of people who go through seminary. There are a lot of people who are on lay leadership who love the idea of the church. And in many ways, that's why you can think you could save it. If we just did more, we could kind of purify this idea. We could just keep this idea going. But Bonhoeffer's really clear that the person who loves the church doesn't love the idea of the church, but loves the real church. And the church is always made up of persons with bodies in a place, which, you know, now has an interesting new wrinkle, thinking about doing church on Zoom and things like that. But he really, you know, thinks that we have to be in a space together. And once that happens, there's going to be conflict. There's going to be what he says discord, and we use as tension. That just happens. And he wants to actually point to that as a sign of life, not as something detrimental. And, you know, this is where it's a little bit politically, you know, incorrect, as he's writing this book in 1938 or whatever, is that he uses the family as an analogy. And his point is, like, healthy families fight all the time. You know, some of the closest families are in discord all the time. You know, like, go on family vacation with a family of five and watch them fight all the way through the airport, and, you know, siblings at each other's throat. And then you also realize that they could never be closer, but the fighting is part of it. Like, it's actually a sign of life. And so if you go into the church, or you think the church has to be perfect in the sense of no discord, no tension, well, it ends up meaning that you don't want a church with real human persons in it, with real questions, with real differences of opinion. And when you lose that, you lose community. And maybe this is the, you know, this is the big struggle, is that we're still, to kind of quote Bonhoeffer again in his doctoral dissertation, that we still tend to think of the church as a volunteer association, which America, like, mastered that the church is, it is, you know, like, a la, you know, Robert Putnam, it is on par with your bowling league or whatever. Like, it's one of your civic collectives that you commit to. In a certain voluntaristic way, you do it. Now, maybe you had some kind of historical reality to that, like, you know, your grandfather was Methodist, so you're going to find a Methodist church. But for the most part, you still chose, you still opted into that. And Bonhoeffer is really he's pretty skeptical of volunteer associations, because he thinks they do tend to be driven by the will of individuals. And it does then give us this kind of idealistic perspective that the church should be perfect. And then the very fuel that starts to kind of run the church is ideology. And now you have to correlate to ideology, and you lose the concreteness of personhood, which calls you into hearing their stories and disagreeing with them, and maybe at sometimes fighting with them, but you're always fighting towards one another, and you're always being held together by this larger story of the very personhood of Jesus Christ, who's bound to us in life and death. I actually think it's like, you know, quite a beautiful sign of life in a church for it to have some discord. Now, dysfunction and discord are different, you know, so there becomes a time when there's utter dysfunction and we need to, you know, call a thing what it is. But no family could survive if you said that it had to be disbanded if there was discord within it. You know, no, you'd never see your siblings after, you know, age four or something.
It almost reminds me of Cheap Grace and Bonhoeffer's Look of Grace, is that really to have community, it's got to be a sense of sacrifice, a sense of paying into it. Was you're volunteering, you're just saying, hey, I'm here, I'm giving my time, and there's not, you know, if you like it, you're going to stay. If you don't like it, you're going to go somewhere else, and you're not going to work to make it better. And we definitely see that in our churches where people will get upset about, the movement of the pews in the worship space. And then when you ask the question, well, were you here to help us make that conversation? Oh no, I don't want to be a part of those conversations because those get tension filled and all that stuff. And it's like, well, we kind of needed that opinion because we made this decision based off of who was there. And I think that when we try to diffuse tension in the sense of like saving the church, we actually cause more harm, because then we're only allowing the people who show up to make the decisions, because they're the ones that are okay with whatever direction, and that those that don't want tension don't want that, you know, sibling conflict. They run and hide, and they make it even harder for us to grow together.
Yeah.
I think the idea of tension is really interesting, especially in the family model, right? Or with the family example. I mean, my wife and I have this conversation all the time. When you stop fighting, do you stop caring, right? Are you willing to go to bat for the things that we go to bat for in our families and our marriage? It's, you know, and with our kids and stuff like that, because we care, or because we just want to win. You know, like I said, dysfunction and discourse are different things, and we have that conversation a lot with amongst my immediate family, but then looking into the rest of our family and trying to figure out, what is it? Is it discord? Is it dysfunction? And how do we navigate this? And you're right. I mean, discord's good. It's healthy. It keeps the conversation going and moves us forward. Good, bad, right, or wrong, right? Whether we agree or not, we're at least having the conversation. And it's when we're unwilling or stop having that conversation, or like Matt said, we are only bringing a certain, you know, the people we agree with into the room, who cares at that point? That's no longer a conversation. It's just an echo chamber. And it's too easy anymore. It's probably always been really easy, but it's too easy anymore of, well, you know, I don't really like what's going on over here. They're not having the conversation I want to have, so I'm gonna go down the street. Or not go, or, you know, there's 5 billion things people could be doing than going to church any day of the week. And how do we do that? You know, I that's what I hear your book exploring, is that idea. How do we do this well, in taking in those conversations and people, and just people, because you're right. When you involve people, it's messy.
Yeah. Yeah. And maybe another, you know, way to frame that we try to get at in the book too, is that, I mean, we don't quite do the kind of dysfunction discord thing, but it builds off some of the ideas there, which maybe a big example of their difference is that dysfunction will lead to pretty severe forms of disconnection. You know, like people will feel alienated from each other, and will feel alienated from the church, and will feel alienated, my gosh, sometimes even feel deeply alienated from God in the midst of that dysfunctional reality, you know. There is a way that kind of discord or certain tensions, even if they're not, you know, like, wow, this is a great experience, but they're hard. You wouldn't choose them. When they come out with a sense of connection, and a word we use for that, building off the German social theorist Hartmut Rose, is the sense of resonance, where you feel a sense of actually being heard, in that there's a connection. And I think some of us who avoid conflict aren't aware that there are people who find themselves in really tense forms of discourse that come out of it feeling very connected, even to the person they completely still do not agree with. But it became an experience of resonance because they felt heard, and there's this kind of mutual kind of discourse within it that connects them to one another. And I do think in the sense of kind of, you know, our marriages and our relationships with spouses and partners and things like that, there is a sense where fighting can become really a valuable thing when it leads to this connection at an end. And one of the reasons you stay in it, you're willing to keep fighting, because there is the sense that this is expressing this, of course, is going to get something off my back, but it also is going to bind us together. It's not going to be a quote unquote enjoyable experience, but it will be a resonant experience. So we do start to really play with this idea of resonance and this sense of what it means to feel this kind of deep sense of connection with one another, and really want that to be the kind of sense of what the church is about, that the church is really about these forms of connection and resonance around our communion with one another and our connection to God. And that's, again, why I said the crisis really is, how do we encounter a living, speaking God? Because the church ultimately is about mediating and witnessing to that kind of connection between humanity and God, that kind of relationship that's at play there. And that can even happen in the midst of our disagreements, if those disagreements bind us further and further in connection. And Paul has all sorts of crazy stuff to say to these churches that he's, a little ticked off with. But his point is, even with these harsh words, is that it will lead them to be connected to one another. And there's all sorts of this language, like, you're my children, we're connected to one another in this way. And because of that, I can say, you're being really stupid, or I don't agree with this. Or, and so I think that kind of that framework of resonance is a really important one for us in this book. I try to deep dive into it in the other books, but this one, we really try to kind of, place it in a way that can kind of frame the way we think about our life together inside of a congregation.
So you have this idea of watchwords. Can you unpack that for me a little bit? Like I read through that chapter and I was like, but mission statements are so important. And then here you are, you threw this idea of having a watchword into my machine, and now I'm trying to refigure out how I want to approach our new mission in the congregation that I serve. And so, can you unpack that for us?
Yeah, I can, and it also feels a little clickbaity too, because we're like, screw mission statements, get a watchword. it feels a little bit rock and roll to get people's attention. But in another level, I think we really do believe it. And this is not to downplay a mission statement. Mission statements are important. I think, so important that almost every institution in America has a mission statement, and the first thing any business or church consultant would tell you is, maybe that's a little bit of an overstatement, but pretty quickly they tell you, you better have a mission statement, why do you exist? Why do you exist? Which is interesting. And it's necessary. I do think it's necessary, but there is a problem with it, is that a mission statement there's a theological problem with it. And the theological problem with it is a mission statement will always fundamentally be about your institution. It has to, almost by its very operations, it has to make your congregation the real star of its own story. It's about you. Why do you exist? Why? And it's, in some sense, this is a little crass and not quite fair, but I think kind of fair, is that it really is about what differentiates you in the market. What are you going to do that's going to differentiate you in the market? And this is just reality. So I would never tell a church, don't ever do a mission statement. You should have a mission statement, but you should also know there's a kind of theological problem here. We inherit a lot of theological problems, just kind of culturally, that we have to negotiate. And this is one of them, which is that theologically, the church has no story other than the story of Jesus Christ, other than God's own story. That's our story. And the star of the church is God. God is the star of the story. The church isn't the star of its own story. That's what's theologically, which is interesting about the church, that the church is here to witness to God's very activity in the world, to minister life out of death to the world. And the church, its responsibility is only to point and witness to that. So a mission statement will always flip things and make you the star of your story. Part of the point of the mission statement is to get clear on your story, on what differentiates you and leads you. But a watchword is different. And a watchword's something that Americans have a hard time with. We just said it, as an idiom, we don't use that often. But if you're in Europe, if you're in the UK, or you're on the continent or something, people often say, oh, this political party, their watchword is this. And it really means the kind of narrative that mobilizes them. what they go into the world looking for. And so this is, we think that this is a, if part of what the church needs to become is a is waiting, we need to wait and wait on God. We don't think you wait like you would wait for a delayed flight like that. No one wants that. You know, like waiting for a delayed flight just sucks. You don't want that. But there is a different kind of waiting that is about anticipation. It's about discernment. It's about looking at what's around us in the present, about anticipating what could be. But the only way to do that is you need a story. Like theologically, we talk about hermeneutics and talk about the need to interpret, and what you're interpreting are narratives and stories. And in the same way, in kind of pastoral ministry, you need to have these stories that you move into the world and you discern how God is acting within your community. So, you know, long story longer, the major point is that a watchword is a kind of shorthand of the stories within this congregation of how God has shown up, how God has moved. And you can't, here's a crazy thing about it. A mission statement you can control. Like you have a retreat, you think about, you work after these 4 hours, we're going to have a mission statement. That's not how a watchword works. A watchword for the most part is uncontrollable. There's a leadership dynamic here where you have to be listening intently to what your congregation is saying. And as a pastor, Mike Woods, says, what you're listening for is where people are telling their stories and it starts to sound like a Bible verse. You know, like they start saying, you know, when things are impossible, God shows up. Or, you know, when I was so lost, that's when God found me. Like when they start saying things like that, you ask to hear more of that story, and then you hold on to those phrases, and it starts resonating with a few other people, and people start telling their own story that way. And then as a congregation, you have a watchword that this is a God moves when all is lost, God acts, and you start to tell your stories that way and send people out in the world to make sense of their lives and to look for God's action through that watchword. So it is a kind of sense of being on watch, looking for how God might move within the world. And I think ultimately that's the kind of ecclesiology we need to in this kind of secular age, is one that really pushes people to seek for God. But you can't just say, this happens all the time in churches, and I just feel like it's somewhat disempowering, is that in a kind of vacuum, you say to people, well, where's God been in your life? And they're like, I don't know. It was really busy at the mall and we got a parking spot right at the front. I guess that was God. And all of a sudden, God is some kind of magical charm or something. But there is a way to frame people that, you know, this God of Israel is a God who always shows up at places of utter impingement, in death, in impossibility, and brings new life out of it. You know, so you can start to, you know, take a kind of watchword like Martin Luther King Jr.'s, is that when there's no way, God makes a way. And that became the civil rights movement kind of watchword, is that they knew is when there was no way, God makes a way. And so your watchword really is the narrative that helps your community anticipate the ways God might move within this community, because God has moved in this way. And it does take a kind of pastoral sense of saying, behold, the Lord has moved in this way. You know, when the ways that you prayed and the ways that you thought through the psalm that you used to get through, you know, Hank's cancer treatments, that's a word for our whole community. And we want to hold that word and see our lives through that word. So that's what we mean by a watchword. I don't know. Does that help?
Yeah. As I was going through that chapter, I was like, man, it's time for me. I guess I need to scrap the idea of a mission statement. But then I started thinking about it and thinking about how almost the struggle of how mission statements can actually hinder us more than they help us, because most of them will be self-centered and they have no real connection to God. And what we're really about is connecting people to God. I mean, that's really what the church does. It helps connect people to God. And very rarely, as I, you know, in my study of mission statements, do churches actually say that's what we do. Now they'll say we'll do this or we do this in the community, sure. But in a sense of actually like connecting people to God, that's not, I mean, from all the ones that I've seen, I don't think I've ever seen one that says, hey, we connect people to God, you know, by doing this. It's, They're more self-centered than anything else.
No, I love the idea of taking that idea of a mission statement, right? But instead of answering the question of what is our mission, leave it open, right? And let the watchwords that come and go. Because, I mean, we could spend another 4 hours on why mission statements are stale and stagnant and aren't working anymore, right? And it's because we get too locked into them and then we don't do anything with them. Like most churches, I'm willing to say most, have a mission statement that's three paragraphs too long. Right? They're too long. Nobody knows them. They don't live into them, all the things. But what if they begin to be, we're connecting people with God. And the rest is the watchwords, right? And they grow and build and change over time, as opposed to, well, every 2 years we take a deep dive into our mission statement with a new pastor or new leadership and what's next, where we go from here. I love that idea. And I love the idea that it's centered around storytelling. Right. I mean, that's the gospels. That's scripture. It's storytelling. And we move through them. And it's the narrative of where God shows up. And I tell my congregations all the time, there's somebody in your life or in your circle or will come into your life that's literally dying to hear your story, to hear where God showed up in your life. And because so many people, oh, I don't have a story. Mine's not all that exciting. You know, it's been a pretty boring life. I don't have anything to share. And it's like, no, somebody needs to hear that. Somebody's dying to hear your story because they're in the same place you were in and they're feeling hopeless. And they need to know where God showed up in your life. That's huge. I mean, that's such sacred stuff that we don't often dig into well in the church, because you know it's hard, it's uncomfortable, we pay a pastor to do that, you know, whatever it is, we have a hard time doing that.
Yeah I mean, it is fascinating. And you know, again, we're really, you know, pulling up the mission statement as our pinata and taking some wax at it here, so I'm a little uncomfortable with that, because I'm sure there's people out there who are like, hey, no, mission statement saved my life, or you know, something like that. So I want to be careful in that, but I do think that they're most often a mission statement breaks down curiosity more than opens it up. You know, like it kind of has this way of demanding conformity, or like, this is the way we're pulling the rope, now let's all pull it. Again, and I don't want to ever like glorify just directionlessness. I think there's a reason we need to have that. And there's a reason we need to be accountable for, like, you know, what is our budget going to be? And so we should know our mission. So we know, you know, our mission statement is, so we know what our budget's going to be. But if that's all there is, it does break down curiosity, you know, and I think a huge piece of this, from a pastoral perspective, whether, you know, whether lay or ordained or whatever, is to be really curious about the stories people are using to make sense of their lives, you know? And so we try to relay these, we give two examples of a watchword at the end of the book. And the one I wrote up that is really meaningful to me, I mean, it just encapsulates it, is like this pastor who I had mentioned earlier, Mike Wood, talked about early in his ministry that he was in charge of the educational ministry at the church, and he had these seventh grade Sunday school teachers who were not following his expertise. Like, he had a mission statement of how, this is how we're going to do Sunday school, this is the mission, therefore this is the form of it. And he'd find these people, they were, you know, older couple, probably close to 60, they'd find them in the weirdest places, like often under the table with these seventh graders, sometimes like in the boiler room next to the, you know, the furnace and things like that. But finally, you know, he's annoyed with this. And finally he got curious and he asked him, like, why are you doing that? What's going on? Well, he also had heard like all these seventh graders loved the Sunday school class. And then people would tell them that for the last 5 or 6 years, this couple named the Jurgensons would call these kids, like when you were six years out of a seventh grade, like you're in your 20s, they would call and sing happy birthday to you. And then Mike's like, man, I wish someone would sing happy birthday to me. So he got curious and he asked them, like, what are you doing? And then he heard what they were saying. He's like, you guys are great Sunday school teachers. And they're like, oh no, we're actually terrible Sunday school teachers. And, no, you guys are great Sunday school teachers. Like, no, we're terrible, because we only have one lesson. And he said, the only thing we ever really tell the kids is that nothing can separate you from God, that nothing can separate you. And then they went on to tell this incredibly moving story about their son, who was, hearing impaired and had really struggled. You know, this is like in the 80s, had really struggled through school and just struggled through accommodations that needed to be made and things like that. Got him through college. He was married, and then he came down with pneumonia and died. And so they were living in just this utter rupture. And so they had told their own boy all the way growing up amidst the struggles, like, nothing can separate you from the love of God. And then that word became so important to them after they dealt with the grief of their son dying. So Mike hears this, and he decides that this is incredible. I mean, he sees that this is a holy moment. And they start using this often, like, nothing can separate us from God. And people knew right away that that also referred back to these the Jorgensens. Like, they knew this, their own kids had been saying this, that they had been given this. And so they started preaching it. They started to talk about it at meetings and in Bible studies. And then Mike says that about, you know, 3 years after doing this, there was a woman in their congregation, they don't know what happened, a young mother who they think maybe got Lyme disease or something, but it thrust her into a terrible place, and she ended up committing suicide. And this watchword, nothing can separate you from the love of God, became just utterly significant, and it framed their congregation for like 8 years. And he's like, then it disappeared and a new one arose. And you just kind of got to go with these ebbs and these flows. But that's what we mean by a watchword. Like, these people had found the very ministering presence of God in their hell, and the only way for them to talk about it was to frame it in a story, and then to hold on to it with a kind of, it's not a catchphrase, but it is like what the reformers talked about, a slogan. You know, like a slogan for Luther in the Reformation is that justification by faith alone. Like, this is, it encompasses a huge doctrinal reality and biblical reality, but it's encompassed in this little phrase, justification by faith alone, or a foreign righteousness, which means that we need God to come to us in our sinfulness. And that's what this watchword came at a congregational level. It was a kind of a theological slogan, a very practical theological slogan of the way God had shown up, the way that God had taken what was dead in these people alive and brought life out of it. And I think if that's what the church does, if the church is waiting on these, finding these words, and then is like, those words become the fire that we kind of huddle around and warm ourselves with. I just feel like that's enough for the church to be like that. That is the incredible witness and an incredible way to live in the world with these words. And yeah, so that's the long story of what a watchword is.
No, I think that helps. Yeah, no, that's great. I think it's something that hopefully our listeners take in and, you know, maybe find ways to incorporate that in their life, but also in their faith communities. It's just a great thing.
It is. I don't think we can tell our story enough. And I don't think we can sit and listen to other people's stories enough. Mm-hmm. Because that's what comes out of it, right? You find Sunday school teachers who are doing an incredible thing, who are like, yeah, we suck at this. This isn't our thing, but they're making a significant difference in getting them to unpack that story as to why and truly helping them see that. I would be willing to bet that's a big narrative of that story, as they begin to see what their story is really doing, and how significant that is. Right. That's huge. Right.
So Andrew, like you said, well, go ahead, Zach.
No, you were going to do it.
Yeah. Okay. So Andrew, you had mentioned that the book, you can Amazon it. I think were the words you used. And so the book you can find in most places, correct?
Yeah. Yep. I think so.
And so, yeah, we'll have a link at least to maybe the Amazon version, if not your publisher's version. So that way you can get a little bit more royalties out of that than what you would get from Amazon.
You know, a cup of coffee is not, you know, it's about what I get. So, you know, but we would be happy for people to get it any way they could. And really, to be honest, and this is the ugly pitch of probably the podcast, is that it is a great book to read with. We hope it's a great book to read with, you know, 10 people in your congregation or something like that. So, yeah, that link from the publisher will get you a better rate on kind of a, you know, over 5, over 10 copies. So,
yeah. And so I'll have a link to that, on the show for this week. Andrew, we want to thank you for your time. You know, you're always welcome to come back. It's always fun to talk with you. I mean, Zach, do you have anything else before we close out?
No, thank you. Is there anything else you want to plug? Please be shameless if you want.
No, I would just, it was great to be on here and talk with you guys. It's always great. You said before we recorded that you want this to have a feel of we're just sitting at a, you know, at a bar or a pub having a beer, but we didn't have beer. So I feel a little disappointed in that. But besides, we got to figure out some technology where you can share a beer through Zoom.
Zoom. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I don't know. Well, you know, if we, depending on states, I know each state is different about being able to send you a beer. Right. We'd be glad to like Grubhub or whatever you a beer, and then we just do it that way. That would probably be the best way right now. Until teleportation becomes a thing. That's probably the way. So
I'm kind of holding out for teleportation, to be honest, but you know, I want to
press. Then we could just show up.
Right. I mean, you know, screw all this stuff about waiting. Then we can just like instant beer would be great. Yeah.
So, you know, our listeners, thank you for listening today. Encourage you to go to our website, beardedtheologians.com. You can find the last time that Andrew was on and talking with us and listen to this one or the many others that we have. And feel free to pick up a t-shirt and, continue to connect with us. So for the Bearded Theologians, I'm Matt Franks.
I'm Zach Bechtold. Thanks for checking us out.
I want you to subscribe and like this video and push that thumbs up.
Thank you for listening to the Bearded Theologians podcast. Don't forget to like, subscribe, and share on all social media outlets. You can check out old episodes and more information at beardedtheologians.com. Thanks for checking us out.